rates where the ultimate end interest rate for the consumer on the long-term mortgage has been extremely volatile and has gone up and down many, many times during the period. The purchaser or the ultimate borrower is very interested in locking in an interest rate as early in the process of the purchase as they possibly can. As an assist and an aid to that consumer, lenders have been able to go out and negotiate forward commitments from secondary market sources such as the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation or the Federal National Mortgage Association and others for a 60-day mandatory delivery commitment for a fee and then lock in that interest rate for the full 30-year term. If indeed the lien period goes beyond the 60 days into the 90, then you put that borrower in some jeopardy in terms of being able to lock in an interest rate. And to go beyond that in a permanent forward commitment, it gets very, very much more expensive. As you increase the risk, the secondary market source is going to cover that risk, too, by an upfront fee.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, if I could make just one additional comment. Mr. Scott said at the end of his testimony that he would like to have a clause added to the bill, if any bill is passed, that says that the change applies only to construction commenced after the effective date of the bill. Normally, I would think that appropriate, but in this case, Mr. Scott has already testified, as have we, that this bill will not change the law. Therefore, it seems to me that to be consistent with that position, it makes no sense to say that this new rule, which is the old rule, will be effective only after the effective date of the bill. So we would maintain that the amendments or the bill should be amended as proposed by the OBA and that an effective date clause should not be added.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Don McKelvey. Or is it McKelvey? Okay, McKelvey.
I'm Don McKelvey. I'm Vice President of First American Title Insurance Company of Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon Land Title Association, speaking on behalf of in favor of the amendment proposed by the bankers, which will basically reenact the law as it was prior to the change in 1985 but simply substituting the 60 for 90 days. The period after completion notice. Mr. Scott may believe that there was no substantial change. We, as a practical matter, have found a considerable change as a result of the 1985 changes. We simply don't know when a project is completed, and I have dealt with this problem on a regular basis for the last 2 years, projects where liens continue to be filed, and we don't know when we're going to get another one. There's simply nothing. We can't go out and inspect a project and sit there permanently to see if someone comes in and installs a ventilating fan or something like that. So we strongly urge that the clock be turned back to reinsert this, whichever is earlier after the completion, to provide for a completion notice. Other than that, that's our primary concern, and we are very hopeful that you will make that change because I can't emphasize the importance to the title industry. It's caused us a tremendous amount of problem. We understand that it also causes problems, and I have seen a frequent number of situations where builders are unable to do anything until they can get their retainage, which is held until we can deliver a clean title report to a lender. I believe the existing circumstances are hurting some builders that are not particularly strong. I've had a number of conversations with counsel for some of the large lenders that are trying to do business in this state or loan in the state, and they don't understand our laws, our lien laws. I don't profess to be an expert in them either. But they are very concerned. When we can't tell them, well, how long do we have to hold these things? And we say, well, we don't know under the current law. And that's the situation. If you have any questions, I'll...
Questions by committee members? All right.
Thank you, Mr. McKelvey.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Cohen.
Have you had a chance to look at the Dash 2 Kalinowski amendments, and have you been listening enough to know that it makes any difference to you in terms of commercial lenders?
I have been listening. I have not seen them. From what I understand, I don't think that that's anything that we have any particular concern about. I haven't conferred with anyone from the association, so I can't speak for them. I don't think that that's a problem for us. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have any other witnesses signed up on Senate Bill 356, so I'll close the public hearing on that, and we'll go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 471.
Mr. Chair.
Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as the testimony proceeds on 471, you may want to also review an amendment that I drafted on behalf of Senator Frey. Both the bill and the amendment accomplish similar results in allowing the court to consider the effects of spousal abuse in the custody decision. The difference between the amendment and the bill is the amendment allows the court to take the abuse into consideration, and if the court finds that the abuse is not in the best interest of the child, then the court will make appropriate custody and visitation arrangements. The difference between that and the printed bill is that the printed bill requires the court to consider the effects of spousal abuse contrary to the best interest. We can discuss that further after the testimony of the witnesses.
Okay. Let's see. Now, that amendment, has everybody got that?
It's labeled Proposed Amendment A to SB 471.
Attached to the back of the staff measure analysis. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Cohen.
Since I'm a sponsor, is Ira here?
Yes.
Okay, are you going to come up first then, or what? He was going to go through the bill.
Sure, I think that'd be, I think they'd
and
do that.
Well, however you're going to, no, I don't care who comes as long as you get quickly through it and
stop.
Tell us the rationale
right.
And...
okay.
Whatever your game plan is, just go ahead.
My name is Ira Zarov. I work for Oregon Legal Services and representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, testifying in support of this bill. The bill basically allows or places into the statute the consideration of spousal abuse as being relevant to the determination of custody and visitation rights. There are several courts in Oregon and in various counties which do not currently allow this evidence into domestic relations suits. And we feel that there's significant evidence, both clinical and that clinical evidence, that this is very relevant to the custody of a child and best interests of the child. So the bill in the first part makes it clear that this sort of evidence is admissible. The second thing the bill does is also an important thing, and that's what the proposed amendment speaks to. Also, the second thing is that it states that if there is spousal abuse, that it shall be considered detrimental to the best interest of the child. And I want to speak to that. And we feel that it's very important that that language remains. And the reason we feel that is that, as Ms. Henderson will testify, and there'll be another witness testifying, there's clinical evidence that supports that kind of presumption that states that if there is spousal abuse, it really is detrimental to the best interest of the child. And one of the things that's happening now in courtrooms is that if you have a skilled attorney in a situation representing a litigant where there's been spousal abuse, they're able to present evidence of that abuse, able to present evidence of, a battered woman syndrome, to make the connection between that kind of abuse and the best interest of the child and how it affects the child. expert testimony does that, and the results in those cases is very different than in cases where there's either not a skilled attorney or there's only a passing reference to this kind of spousal abuse. So if someone is either indigent and is not represented or has an unskilled attorney, you get a very different result even when you have the same spousal kind of abuse. And the reason for that isn't that in the one case where custody may be determined in favor of the person who was the victim of spousal abuse and visitation may be affected because of that. Those are reasonable outcomes of a household, in a household where there's spousal abuse, that's a reasonable outcome. Those things should be affected. But when you have someone, an attorney who doesn't raise those issues, the court should still take into account those in a very strong way. And when you're talking about the best interest of the child, the skill of the attorney or the indigency of, one of the parties should not have a significant outcome on the effect. And we think by placing a presumption in the bill, such as this, that it shall be considered detrimental to the best interest of the child, will avoid that kind of result. We understand that there are some concerns about essentially situations where there may be not a tremendous amount of violence or an isolated incidence of violence, and putting this presumption in may, in effect, be viewed as tying the judge's hand. We don't think that that will be the result. We think judges will still be able to say, yes, there has been spousal abuse, and I find that is detrimental to the best interest of the child. But when I weigh all the other factors, I still find that custody should go to, in some instances, perhaps the abusing person or the person who committed one incident of spousal abuse. We don't think that it would preclude that result, but we do think that spousal abuse is very serious. It affects children danger in a negative way, and that this amendment is, or this Senate bill, the way it's written, is supportable. Thank you.
Where do I get the definition of abuse now?
Well, it's abuse. I don't think that this bill defines it. It's certainly defined in the Abuse Prevention Act. I think that it's...
Well, is that what you mean here by using the word abuse in this bill? You mean as defined in the Abuse Prevention Act?
I think that what is probably contemplated is not reference to that statute, but the Children's Services Guidelines, which Ms. Henderson will speak to, and then actually, it's unclear probably.
Yeah, well,
yeah, it's probably somewhat ambiguous.
One of the things I'm a little concerned about. Okay.
I think that defining it either in terms of the Children's Services Guidelines or the Abuse Prevention Act might be a reasonable approach.
Who's next? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Donna Henderson. I'm a registered clinical social worker and work as a consulting school social worker in Lynn and Benton counties. I'm testifying today in strong support of this bill, and my testimony represents the position of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. My experience and the experience of numerous colleagues and current research findings all point unequivocally, I believe, to the conclusion that the existence of the abuse of one parent by the other both significantly increases the risk of abuse of and psychosocial damage to children in the household. The damaging effects of spousal violence are recognized and considered already in Oregon Children's Service Division guidelines for determining child protective service eligibility, which state that, quote, mental injury may result from exposure to repeated violent, brutal, or intimidating acts and or statements among members of the household or against other persons. In fact, such mental injury is now considered reportable abuse, and numerous studies have linked family violence in general to significant academic, disciplinary, social, and health problems in children. The patterns and characteristics of domestic violence are by now well documented by a substantial number of studies and clinical reports. In fact, the most common pattern is for the most powerful to abuse the least powerful in the family. As such, withdrawal of the targeted spouse in an abusive relationship virtually paints a target on the next least powerful, which is the child. And in fact, it has been determined that there is a high degree of overlap between spouse abuse and child abuse. One concern which fairly arises in consideration of any law which would question the suitability of granting custody to the perpetrator in spouse abuse is whether or not a single incident of violence would or should be grounds to deny custody. Again, research and clinical evidence repeatedly demonstrate that spouse abuse is almost never an isolated incident, despite the fact that it is frequently self-reported to be. Rather, once the boundary has been crossed once, violence quickly becomes part of the repertoire of family interactions, taking less and less provocation to commence and increasing in frequency and severity. As social workers, we have seen these patterns play themselves out with predictable and frightening consistency. Concerning the issue of maternal and paternal preference in custody decisions, the position that I and my association support is that which gives equal consideration to both parents as described in this bill. There exists no conclusive evidence that either maternal or paternal custody is intrinsically preferable. In fact, several studies have found the incidence of abuse to be higher among mothers than fathers. In the extreme, a national study in 1979 found that natural mothers were involved in all forms of maltreatment nearly twice as often as natural fathers, 75% as compared to 41%. I do want to point out that those figures don't reflect the fact that the bulk, of course, of child care is done by the mother, so that most of the time spent by a child with parents is spent with the mother. And when that's broken down and averaged in, it comes out much closer to a 50-50 kind of ratio. Other studies do report percentages to be things like 47% mothers, 39% fathers, to 50% mothers, and 45% fathers, with the remaining percentages assigned to other family members or relatives. Overall, there appears to be at minimum an even split between fathers and mothers as abusers, with dads looking slightly better statistically. And as a side note, it does seem to be, or some studies have found, that mothers may be the ones who commit the more serious abuse. I think the point here is not that mothers should not be given custody. I certainly would never say that. But that the convention of giving preference to the mother is based on an assumption that such a convention automatically serves the best interests of the child, which is an assumption that the evidence just consistently fails to support. In sum, Senate Bill 471 represents a much-needed piece of legislation, long overdue, which would help to facilitate responsive and responsible judicial decisions which are truly responsive to the best interests of individual children. Again, I and the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers strongly urge its passage, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you in its favor.
All right. Go ahead.
My name is Vieta Helmley, and I represent the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and work for the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service here in Salem. I have a story to tell you. I'll call this person Lucy. Lucy was married to a school teacher for many years and had two children. Her husband hit her a few times before the breakup of the relationship, before it finally ended. And by hit her a few times, I mean he shook her, he tossed her against the wall once, and slapped her a couple of times. What the layperson might say, oh, well, that's no big deal. The divorce that they went through was very, very bitter, and custody ended up in the hands of the father. He ended up being the sole custodian. Lucy was allowed visitation, and Lucy lost all her property and most of her financial assets. Then, after about 4 years of litigation, the victim had visitation with her child throughout the 4 years of litigation. During the last year, her oldest child started hitting her, which is a pattern that we see in domestic violence households. And she took the child into a therapist, and the therapist, in his work, found out that the child was being physically abused at home. And we know where this is going to end up. The child is 11 years old now. In time, the child will be married, and the child will undoubtedly continue to assault people unless the therapy is successful.
Okay, now, let's see. Does anyone feel that under the present law that the court does not take this into consideration?
Chairman, yes. There's testimony from Ms. Dabney in there who practices as a social worker in the Eugene area, which she notes that she feels it's not taken into consideration properly in numerous instances, and explains the differences when there is expert testimony on the issues and when there's just basic passing mention of spousal abuse. In several counties, in Marion County, it's not admissible at all in the current system. And in Coos County, spousal abuse is only admitted if there's a temporary abuse prevention order issued. And in other counties, the individual predilections of the judge's control, although it's somewhat uneven. And there's also evidence that it's not taken into account at the same level that we believe it should.
Are there, can you think of any instance where abuse of whatever it finally turns out to be defined as could occur that wouldn't have any effect on the child?
Murray Strauss is a sociologist, and he's been in the business for a long time, and his work going back a number of years indicates that the effects of domestic violence on a child who witnesses it is very nearly the same as if they were abused themselves.
Well, okay, that's what I'm getting at. Now, suppose we've got a six-week-old child who lies in his crib and never witnesses any of this. How does the fact that there is an instance of abuse or abuse, whatever, however it's defined, how is that going to affect the welfare of the child?
I think that there's a great deal of evidence without counseling, people who are abusive in one setting are abusive in the next setting, in another similar setting. And that should be taken into account, even in the instance of a six-week-old child, if they're going to have visitation or that person who's an abuser has custody, there's a very good chance that it will repeat itself. And in that instance, it certainly should be considered by the judge.
Well, okay, and I don't disagree with that.
I understand.
But the way this thing is presently worded, it sounds like it doesn't leave the court too much discretion as to whether this, in fact, is going to, you know, the court shall consider this as being contrary to the best interest of the child. I would, well, that's the posture it's put in right now. I'm just, right. I have some questions about that.
We can work on that.
Well, my position, I guess, is that it really does, the judge can still decide in that instance that custody should be with that person, weighing the totality of the, of everything that's admitted, all the evidence.
I certainly think that we could improve the law by saying that this should be a factor that the court, I'm surprised that judges don't do this universally, but you say that not all of them do.
No, they don't.
So I'm certainly inclined to say we ought to fix that up. But, well, anyway, give some thought to the amendment that's been proposed, if you would. Any questions by the committee members? All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, for any of the witnesses, particularly Mr. Zaroff, if a temporary restraining order is issued under the Abuse Prevention Act, I'd like you to respond under the situation in which the order is granted ex parte, and secondly, in the situation where the order is granted after a contested hearing, do you think that that would be either evidence or prima facie evidence or conclusive of abuse as defined in the proposed bill?
I think that ex parte not appealed, and after a hearing, that it probably would be there would be an effect on the divorce, and it would be collateral estoppel and probably proven for the purposes of a dissolution. In other words, yes, it would have an effect in both instances, and that effect would be that abuse would probably be proven. I would have to do some research to be certain, but that it would be my first impression.
Thank you.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you seen the amendments that...
Yes, I have.
What, do you have a response to them now, or do you want to look at them?
Well, my response is that we think that the bill is written is probably the best result, and that bill, under it, judges could still discount spousal abuse in evaluating the case, and we don't want them to be able to do that. We certainly will look at that again and work and try to work on some compromise.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? All right. Thank you, then. And
thank you.
Is Rhonda Parent here?
Stay up here with Ms. Parent.
My name is Rhonda Parent, testifying in support of Bill number 471. For one, this is a subject which is a very close topic in my life. As a child and now an adult, the abuse which I witnessed has affected my life. I am currently coming to terms with how I feel about my childhood.
You're doing all right. Just keep going. Take kind of a deep breath and finish your story to us.
And I feel that I may be now in a position to participate in counseling. It may not seem that way, but I'm working on it. It has taken me years just to learn to cope with my feelings toward my father. He abused my mother brutally. If I was ordered to visit my father, I could not. Why? Because I am afraid of him for what he did to my mom and for not knowing if I will be the next target. Please let me say that the abused should be heard. I am sorry that I cannot go into the subject in more detail, but I'm afraid to believe what I've witnessed could actually be true.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
No, I don't have any more witnesses sign up for 471, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 471. It's time for tough decisions by the chair. Since I haven't had to make any all session, I'll make one now. We have two bills left, 441. We've got 11 witnesses signed up for, and 358. We've got 13 witnesses. Every witness on both bills has got blood in his eye, so I don't expect them to be terribly brief. I'm going to, and since a lot of the people signed up on 441 are also signed up on 358, I'm going to take 441 off today. It'll be put back on later. And we're going to go to Senate Bill 358 now. Now, well, not right this minute. Possibly in the 21st. Now, regarding the Senate Bill 358, I've got Senator Houck is going to be here. He's not here yet. Representative Sides, Representative Kopetsky. I'm going to try and accommodate them as they appear. So if they're here, I will put them ahead. Otherwise, the order of witnesses will be hopefully something like this, subject to change. Keith Meisenheimer, Tom English, Alan Bailey, Rhonda Northrup, and Lou Broadbent? Broadbent? Is it Lou? Okay. Elise Clausen and Don Welch, then Judge Norblad, Cindy Nielsen, Larry Buck, Donna Lay, Brent Carlson. But I'll stop there. There's enough to keep us going for a while. And we'll decide. I'm not too sure how long this hearing is going to last now, so if everybody down there thinks that you're going to be able to get up here and talk for a long time,